Disc 20.
In the first week of July, I announced that our economy had now produced 22 million jobs since I took office and went out to the old soldiers' home a few miles north of the White House to protect the old cottage Abraham Lincoln and his family had used for a summer home when the Potomac generated hordes of mosquitoes and there was no air conditioning. Several other presidents had used it, too. It was one of Hillary's Save America's Treasures projects, and we wanted to know the old place would be cared for when we left the White House. On July 11th, I opened a summit with Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat at Camp David in an attempt to resolve the remaining obstacles to peace, or at least to narrow their differences so that we could finish before I left office, a result both leaders said they wanted. They came to the summit with very different attitudes. Barak had pushed hard for the summit because the piecemeal approach of the 1993 agreement and the Y River Accord didn't work for him. The 180,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank and Gaza were a formidable force. Every Israeli concession that failed to bring an end to terror and a formal Palestinian recognition that the conflict was over was a death by a thousand cuts. Barak had just survived a no-confidence vote in the Knesset by only 2 votes. He was also eager for a deal before September, when Arafat had threatened to unilaterally declare a state. Barak believed that if he could present a comprehensive peace plan to Israeli citizens, they would vote for it as long as Israel's fundamental interests were achieved. Security, the protection of its religious and cultural sites on the Temple Mount, an end to the Palestinian claim to an unlimited right of return to Israel, and a declaration that the conflict was over. Arafat, on the other hand, didn't want to come to Camp David, at least not yet. He had felt abandoned by the Israelis when they turned to the Syrian track, and was angry that Barak had not kept previous commitments to turn over more of the West Bank, including villages near Jerusalem. In Arafat's eyes, Barak's unilateral withdrawal from Lebanon and his offer to withdraw from the Golan had weakened him. While Arafat had patiently continued the peace process, Lebanon and Syria had benefited by taking a hard line. Arafat also said he needed 2 more weeks to develop his proposals. He wanted as close to 100% of the West Bank and Gaza as he could get, complete sovereignty over the Temple Mount and East Jerusalem, except for the Jewish neighborhoods there, and a solution to the refugee problem that did not require him to give up the principle of the right of return. As usual, each leader saw his own position more clearly than he saw the other side. There was not a high probability of success for the summit. I called it because I believed that the collapse of the peace process would be a near certainty if I didn't. On the first day, I tried to get Arafat past his grievances to focus on the work ahead and to get Barak to agree on how to move through the issues, especially the most contentious ones: territory, settlements, refugees, security, and Jerusalem. As he had at Shepherdstown, Barak wanted to slow walk things for a couple of days. It didn't matter that much this time. Arafat hadn't come with a set of negotiating points. This was all strange territory to him. In previous negotiations, he would just hold out for the best offer he could get from Israel on issues such as land, an airport, connecting roads, and prisoner releases, then pledge his best efforts on the security front. Now, if we were going to get this done, Arafat had some compromising of his own to do on concrete matters. He couldn't get 100% of the West Bank or an unlimited right of return to a much smaller Israel. He also would have to meet some of Israel's security concerns about potential enemies east of the Jordan River. I spent the first couple of days trying to get Arafat and Barak in the right frame of mind, while Madeline, Sandy, Dennis, Gamal Halal, John Podesta, and the rest of our team began working with their Israeli and Palestinian counterparts. I was immensely impressed with the quality of both delegations. They were all patriotic, intelligent, and hard-working, and they genuinely seemed to want an agreement. Most of them had known each other and their counterparts on the other side for years, and the chemistry between the two groups was quite good. We tried to create a comfortable, informal atmosphere for the Israelis and Palestinians. In addition to our regular Middle East team, I asked Hillary's aide, Huma Abedin, to join us. An Arabic-speaking Muslim American raised in Saudi Arabia, Huma was an impressive young woman who understood the Middle East and was especially effective at making the Israeli and Palestinian delegates feel at home and at ease. Capricia Marshall, the White House social secretary, arranged for the White House butlers, chefs, and valets to come help the Camp David staff in making sure the meals were enjoyable. And Chelsea stayed with me the whole time, entertaining our guests and helping me deal with the endless hours of tension. Most nights we all had dinner together at Laurel, the large gathering cabin at Camp David, which had dining facilities, a large den, a meeting room, and my private office. Breakfast and lunch were more informal, and the Israelis and Palestinians could often be seen talking among themselves in small groups. Sometimes it was business. Often they were telling stories and jokes or relating family histories. Abu Ala and Abu Mazen were Arafat's oldest and longest-serving advisors. Abu Ala took a lot of kidding from the Israelis and the Americans for his family. His father was so prolific that the 63-year-old Palestinian had an 8-year-old brother. The boy was younger than some of Abu's own grandchildren. Eli Rubenstein, the Israeli attorney general, knew more jokes than I did and told them better. While the chemistry between the teams was good, the same could not be said of Arafat and Barak. I had put them in cabins close to mine and visited at length with both of them every day, but they didn't visit each other. Arafat continued to feel aggrieved. Barak didn't want to meet alone with Arafat. He was afraid that they would fall into the old patterns where Barak did all the giving and Arafat made no response in kind. Ehud spent most of the day in his cabin, much of it on the phone to Israel, trying to hold his coalition together. By this time, I had gotten to understand Barak better. He was brilliant and brave, and he was willing to go a long way on Jerusalem and on territory, but he had a hard time listening to people who didn't see things the way he did, and his way of doing things was diametrically opposed to honored customs among the Arabs with whom I dealt. Barak wanted others to wait until he decided the time was right. Then, when he made his best offer, he expected it to be accepted as self-evidently a good deal. His negotiating partners wanted trust-building courtesies and conversations and lots of bargaining. The culture clash made my team's job harder. They came up with a variety of strategies to break the impasse, and some progress was made after the delegations broke up into different groups to work on specific issues, but neither side had permission to go beyond a certain point. On the sixth day, Shlomo ben Ami and Gilad Shur, with Barak's blessing, went well beyond previously stated Israeli positions in the hope of getting some movement from Saeb Erekat and Mohammed Dahlan, younger members of Arafat's team, who we all believed wanted a deal. When the Palestinians didn't offer Barak anything in return for his moves on Jerusalem and territory, I went to see Arafat, taking Halal with me to interpret and Mali to take notes. It was a tough meeting, and it ended with my telling Arafat that I would end the talks and say he had refused to negotiate unless he gave me something to take back to Barak, who was off the wall because Ben Ami and Shur had gone as far as they had and gotten nothing in return. After a while, Arafat gave me a letter that seemed to say that if he was satisfied with the Jerusalem question, I could make the final call on how much land the Israelis kept for settlements and what constituted a fair land swap. I took the letter to Barak and spent a lot of time talking to him, often alone or with the NSC note-taker for Israel, Bruce Rydell. Eventually, Barak agreed that Arafat's letter might mean something. On the seventh day, July 17th, we almost lost Barak. He was eating and working when he choked on a peanut and stopped breathing for about 40 seconds, until Gid Gernstein, the youngest member of his delegation, administered the Heimlich maneuver. Barak was a tough customer. When he got his breath back, he went back to work as if nothing had happened. For the rest of us, nothing was happening. Barack had kept his entire delegation working with him all day long and into the night. In any process like this, there are always periods of downtime when some people are working and others aren't. You have to do something to break the tension. I spent several hours of my downtime playing cards with Joe Lockhart, John Podesta, and Doug Band. Doug had worked at the White House for 5 years while putting himself through graduate and law school at night, and in the spring had become my last presidential aide. He had an interest in the Middle East and was very helpful to me. Chelsea played cards, too. She made the highest oh-hell score in the entire 2 weeks at Camp David. It was after midnight when Barack finally came to me with proposals. They were less than what Ben-Ami and Schur had already presented to the Palestinians. Ehud wanted me to present them to Arafat as U.S. proposals. I understood his frustration with Arafat, but I couldn't do that. It would have been a disaster, and I told him so. We talked until 2:30. At 3:15, he came back, and we talked another hour alone on the back porch of my cabin. Essentially, he gave me the go-ahead to see if I could work out a deal on Jerusalem and the West Bank that he could live with, and that was consistent with what Ben-Ami and Schur had discussed with their counterparts. That was worth staying up for. On the morning of the eighth day, I was feeling both anxious and hopeful. Anxious because I had been scheduled to leave for the G8 summit in Okinawa, which I had to attend for a variety of reasons, and hopeful because Barack's sense of timing and his enormous courage had kicked in. I delayed my departure to Okinawa by a day and met with Arafat. I told him that I thought he could get 91% of the West Bank, plus at least a symbolic swap of land near Gaza and the West Bank, a capital in East Jerusalem, sovereignty over the Muslim and Christian quarters of the Old City and the outer neighborhoods of East Jerusalem, planning, zoning, and law enforcement authority over the rest of the eastern part of the city, and custodianship, but not sovereignty, over the Temple Mount, which was known as Haram al-Sharif to the Arabs. Arafat balked at not having sovereignty over all of East Jerusalem, including the Temple Mount. He turned the offer down. I asked him to think about it. While he fretted and Barack fumed, I called Arab leaders for support. Most wouldn't say much for fear of undercutting Arafat. On the ninth day, I gave Arafat my best shot again. Again, he said no. Israel had gone much further than he had, and he wouldn't even embrace their moves as the basis for future negotiations. Again, I called several Arab leaders for help. King Abdullah and President Ben Ali of Tunisia tried to encourage Arafat. They told me he was afraid to make compromises. It looked as if the talks were dead and on disastrous terms. Both sides clearly wanted a deal, so I asked them to stay and work while I was in Okinawa. They agreed, though after I left, the Palestinians still refused to negotiate on the basis of the ideas I had advanced, saying they had already rejected them. Then the Israelis balked. That was in part my fault. Apparently, I had not been as clear with Arafat as I thought I had been about what the terms of staying on should be. I had left Madeline and the rest of our team with a real mess. She took Arafat to her farm and Barack to the famous Civil War battlefield at nearby Gettysburg. It lightened them up, but nothing happened between them. Shlomo Ben-Ami and Amnon Shahak, himself a former general, had good talks with Mohammed Dahlan and Mohammed Rashid, but they were the most forward-leaning of their respective groups. Even if they agreed on everything, they probably couldn't get their leaders on board. I returned on the 13th day of discussions, and we worked all night again, mostly on security issues. Then we did it again on the 14th day, going well past 3 a.m. before giving up, when effective control over the Temple Mount and all East Jerusalem was not enough for Arafat without the word sovereignty. In a last-ditch effort, I offered to try to sell Barack on full sovereignty for East Jerusalem's outer neighborhoods, limited sovereignty over the inner ones, and custodial sovereignty over the Haram. Again, Arafat said no. I shut down the talks. It was frustrating and profoundly sad. There was little difference between the two sides on how the affairs of Jerusalem would actually be handled. It was all about who got to claim sovereignty. I issued a statement saying I had concluded that the parties could not reach agreement at this time, given the historical, religious, political, and emotional dimensions of the conflict. To give Barak some cover back home and indicate what had occurred, I said that while Arafat had made clear that he wanted to stay on the path of peace, Barak had shown particular courage, vision, and an understanding of the historical importance of this moment. I said that the two delegations had shown each other a genuine respect and understanding unique in my 8 years of peacemaking around the world, and for the first time had openly discussed the most sensitive matters in dispute. We now had a better idea of each side's bottom line, and I still believed we had a chance to reach an agreement before the year was out. Arafat had wanted to continue the negotiations, and on more than one occasion had acknowledged that he was unlikely to get a future Israeli government or American team so committed to peace. It was hard to know why he had moved so little. Perhaps his team really hadn't worked through the hard compromises. Perhaps they wanted one session to see how much they could squeeze out of Israel before showing their hand. For whatever reasons, they had left Barak exposed in a precarious political situation. It was not for nothing that he was the most decorated soldier in the history of Israel. For all his brusque bullheadedness, he had taken great risks to win a more secure future for Israel. In my remarks to the press, I assured the people of Israel that he had done nothing to compromise their security and said that they should be very proud of him. Arafat was famous for waiting until the very last minute to make a decision, or 5 minutes to midnight, as we used to say. I had only 6 months to go as president. I certainly hoped Arafat's watch kept good time. Chapter 55. While the Camp David talks were going on, positive things happened elsewhere. Charlene Barshefsky completed a sweeping trade agreement with Vietnam, and the House adopted an amendment by my longtime supporter Maxine Waters that funded a down payment on our share of the Millennium Debt Relief effort. By this time, debt relief had an amazing array of supporters led by Bono. By then, Bono had become a fixture in Washington political life. He turned out to be a first-class politician, partly through the element of surprise. Larry Summers, who knew everything about economics but little about popular culture, came into the Oval Office one day and remarked that he had just had a meeting on debt relief with some guy named Bono, just one name, dressed in jeans, a T-shirt, and big sunglasses. He came to see me about debt relief, and he knows what he's talking about. The trip to Okinawa was a big success, as the G8 put some teeth into our commitment to have all the world's children in primary school by 2015. I led off with a $300 million program to provide one good meal a day to 9 million children, provided they came to school to get the meal. The initiative had been brought to me by our ambassador to the UN food programs in Rome, George McGovern. McGovern's old partner in pioneering food stamps, Bob Dole, and Congressman Jim McGovern of Massachusetts. I also visited the U.S. forces in Okinawa, thanked Prime Minister Yoshiro Mori for letting them be stationed there, and pledged to reduce the tensions our presence had caused. It was my last G8 summit, and I was sorry to rush through it to get back to Camp David. The other leaders had been very supportive of my initiatives over 8 years, and we had accomplished a lot together. Chelsea traveled to Okinawa with me. One of the best things about the year for both Hillary and me was that Chelsea was home for the last half of it. She had amassed far more credits in her first 3 years at Stanford than she needed to graduate, so that she could spend the last 6 months in the White House with us. Now she would be dividing her time between campaigning for her mother and helping me with events in the White House and going with me on foreign trips. She did a great job on both counts, and her presence made life much better for her parents. At the end of the month, I resumed my battle with the Republicans over tax cuts. They still wanted to spend a decade's worth of projected surpluses on them, claiming that the money belonged to the taxpayers and we should give it back to them. It was a persuasive argument except for one thing. The surpluses were projected, and the tax cuts would take effect whether the surpluses materialized or not. I attempted to illustrate the point by asking people to imagine that they had gotten one of those heavily advertised letters from well-known TV personality Ed McMahon that started with, "You may have already won $10 million. I said that the people who would spend $10 million upon receiving that letter should support the Republican plan. Everybody else should stick with us and keep the prosperity going. August was a busy month. It began with the nomination of George W. Bush and Dick Cheney in Philadelphia. Hillary and I went to Martha's Vineyard for a couple of fundraisers for her, then I flew to Idaho to visit firefighters who were fighting a large and dangerous forest fire. On the 9th, I awarded the Medal of Freedom to 15 Americans, including the late Senator John Chafee, Senator Pat Moynihan, Children's Defense Fund founder Marion Edelman, AIDS activist Dr. Matilda Krim, Jesse Jackson, civil rights lawyer Judge Cruz Reynoso, and General Wes Clark, who had ended his brilliant military career by commanding our arduous campaign against Milosevic and his ethnic cleansing in Kosovo. Amid a blizzard of political events, I did one completely non-political one. I went to my friend Bill Hybels' Willow Creek Community Church in South Barrington, Illinois, near Chicago, for a conversation before several hundred people at Bill's Ministries Leadership Conference. We talked about when I decided to go into politics, where my family went to church and what it meant to me, why so many people still believed I had never apologized for my misconduct, how I used polls, what the most important elements of leadership were, and how I wanted to be remembered. Hybels had an uncanny way of stripping things down to basics and getting me to discuss things I normally would not talk about. I enjoyed taking a few hours away from politics and work to think about the inner life that politics often crowds out. On August 14th, opening night of the Democratic Convention, Hillary gave a moving expression of thanks to the Democrats for their support and a mighty declaration of what was at stake in this year's election. Then, after my third convention film produced by Harry and Linda Thomason, which outlined the accomplishments of our 8 years, I was brought on stage to thunderous applause and inspirational music. When the noise died down, I said that the election was about one simple question. Are we going to keep this progress and prosperity going? I asked the Democrats to make sure we applied President Reagan's 1980 standard for whether a party should continue in office. Are we better off today than we were 8 years ago? The answer proved that Harry Truman was right when he said, "If you want to live like a Republican, you better vote for the Democrats." The crowd roared. We were better off, and not just economically. Jobs were up, but so were adoptions. The debt was down, but so was teen pregnancy. We were becoming both more diverse and more united. We had built and crossed our bridge to the 21st century, and we're not going back. I made the case for a Democratic Congress, saying that what we did with our prosperity was just as sure a test of America's character, values, and judgment as how we had dealt with adversity in the past. If we had a Democratic Congress, America would already have the Patient's Bill of Rights, a minimum wage increase, stronger equal pay laws for women, and middle-class tax cuts for college tuition and long-term care. I praised Hillary for 30 years of public service, and especially her work in the White House for children and families, and said that just as she had always been there for our family, she would always be there for the families of New York and America. Then I argued for Al Gore, emphasizing his strong convictions, good ideas, understanding of the future, and fundamental decency. I thanked Tipper for her mental health advocacy and applauded Al's selection of Joe Lieberman and spoke of our 30-year friendship and Joe's work for civil rights in the South in the 60s. As the first Jewish American ever to be on a major party's national ticket, Joe provided clear evidence of Al Gore's commitment to building one America. I ended the speech with personal thanks and a personal plea. My friends, 54 years ago this week, I was born in a summer storm to a young widow in a small southern town. America gave me the chance to live my dreams, and I have tried as hard as I knew how to give you a better chance to live yours. Now my hair is a little grayer, my wrinkles are a little deeper, but with the same optimism and hope I brought to the work I loved so 8 years ago, I want you to know my heart is filled with gratitude. My fellow Americans, the future of our country is now in your hands. You must think hard, feel deeply, and choose wisely. And remember, keep putting people first. Keep building those bridges. And don't stop thinking about tomorrow. The next day, Hillary, Chelsea, and I flew to Monroe, Michigan for a Passing the Torch rally with Al and Tipper Gore. A good crowd in a battleground state sent Al off to Los Angeles to claim the nomination and become the leader of our party, and me to the local McDonald's, a stop I hadn't made in years. The Bush-Cheney ticket had settled on a two-pronged campaign message. The positive argument was compassionate conservatism, giving America the same good conditions we had provided, but with a smaller government and a bigger tax cut. The negative one was that they would elevate the moral tone and end bitter partisanship in Washington. That was, to say the least, disingenuous. I had done everything I knew to reach out to the Republicans in Washington. They had tried to demonize me from day one. Now they were saying, "We'll stop misbehaving if you give us the White House back." The morality argument should have had no resonance, unless people believed Gore had done something wrong, especially with the super straight Lieberman on the ticket. I wasn't on the ballot. It was both unfair and self-defeating for voters to blame them for my personal mistakes. I knew their strategy wouldn't work unless the Democrats accepted the legitimacy of the Republican argument and failed to remind voters of the impeachment fiasco and how much more damage the right wing could inflict if they controlled both the White House and the Congress. An NRA vice president had already boasted that if Bush were elected, the NRA would have an office in the White House. After our convention, the poll showed Al Gore had come from behind to hold a narrow lead, and I accompanied Hillary to the Finger Lakes area of upstate New York for a couple of days of vacation and campaigning. She was running a different race from the one she had begun. Mayor Giuliani had withdrawn, and her new opponent, Long Island Congressman Rick Lazio, presented a new challenge. He was attractive and smart, a less polarizing figure who was nevertheless more conservative than Giuliani. I ended the month with two short trips. After meeting in Washington with Vicente Fox, the president-elect of Mexico, I flew to Nigeria to see President Olusegun Obasanjo. I wanted to support his efforts to curb AIDS before Nigeria's infection rates reached the levels of southern African nations, and to highlight the recent passage of the African Trade Bill, which I hoped would help Nigeria's struggling economy. Obasanjo and I attended a gathering on AIDS, at which a young girl spoke of her efforts to educate her schoolmates about the disease, and a man named Johnny Bekwe told the gripping story of his marriage to a woman who was HIV positive, his becoming infected, and his frantic search to get the medicine for his wife that would enable their child to be born without the virus. Eventually, John succeeded, and little Maria was born HIV-free. President Obasanjo asked Mrs. Ibekwe to come up on stage, where he embraced her. It was a touching gesture and sent a clear signal that Nigeria would not fall into the trap of denial that had contributed so much to the spread of AIDS in other countries. From Nigeria, I flew to Arusha, Tanzania, to the Burundi peace talks, which Nelson Mandela had been chairing. Mandela wanted me to join him and several other African leaders for the closing session to exhort the leaders of Burundi's numerous factions to sign the agreement and avoid another Rwanda. Mandela gave me clear instructions. We were doing a good cop, bad cop routine. I would give a positive speech urging them to do the right thing. Then Mandela would demand that the party sign on to his proposal. It worked. President Pierre Buyoya and 13 of the 19 warring parties signed the agreement. Soon all but two of them would sign. Although it was a burdensome trip, going to the Burundi Peace Conference was an important way to demonstrate to Africa and the world that the United States was a peacemaker. As I said to myself before we began our Camp David talks, we're either going to succeed or get caught trying. On August 30th, I flew to Cartagena, Colombia, with Speaker Dennis Hastert and six other House members, Senator Joe Biden and three other senators, and several cabinet members. We all wanted to reinforce America's commitment to President Andres Pastrana's Plan Colombia, which was intended to free his country of the narco traffickers and terrorists who controlled about one-third of its territory. Pastrana had risked his life in an attempt to make peace, going alone to meet with the guerrillas in their lair. When he failed, he had asked the United States to help him defeat them with Plan Colombia. With Hastert's strong support, I had gotten more than $1 billion from Congress to do our part. Cartagena is a beautiful old walled city. Pastrana took us out into the streets to meet officials who were fighting the narco traffickers and some of the people who had been affected by the violence, including the widow of a police officer slain in the line of duty, one of hundreds killed for their honesty and bravery. Andres also introduced Chelsea and me to an adorable group of young musicians who call themselves the Children of Vallenato, their home village, in an area often ruled by violence. They sang and danced for peace in traditional native dress, and that evening in the streets of Cartagena, Pastrana, Chelsea, and I danced with them. At the end of the first week of September, after vetoing a bill repealing the estate tax, announcing that I would defer a decision on deploying a missile defense system to my successor, and campaigning with Hillary at the New York State Fair, I went to the United Nations for its Millennium Summit. It was the largest assembly of world leaders ever gathered. My last UN speech was a brief but impassioned appeal for international cooperation on the issues of security, peace, and shared prosperity in order to build a world that operated according to simple rules. Everyone counts, everyone has a role to play, and we all do better when we help each other. After the speech, I walked into the hall to sit with Madeleine Albright and Dick Holbrooke to listen to the next speaker, President Mohammad Khatami of Iran. Iran had held several elections in recent years, for the presidency, for parliament, and for municipal offices. In every case, the reformers had won between 2/3 and 70% of the vote. The problem was that under the Iranian constitution, a council of Islamic fundamentalists led by Ayatollah Sayed Ali Khamenei held enormous power. They could nullify certain legislation and prohibit candidates from running for office. And they controlled Iran's foreign intelligence operations and funded its support for terrorism. We had tried to reach out to Khatami and to promote more people-to-people contacts. I had also said that the United States was wrong to support the overthrow of an elected government in Iran in the 1950s. I hoped my gesture of respect would make more progress possible under the next president. Kofi Annan and I hosted the traditional luncheon, and when it was over, I followed my usual custom of standing by my table to shake hands with the leaders who stopped by on their way out. I thought I was at the end when I shook hands with a giant Namibian official who towered over me. He then moved on, revealing a last greeter who had been invisible behind him, Fidel Castro. Castro stuck out his hand and I shook it, the first president to do so in more than 40 years. He said he didn't wish to cause me any trouble, but wanted to pay his respects before I left office. I replied that I hoped that someday our nations would be reconciled. After the UN meetings, OPEC announced an increase in oil production of 800,000 barrels a day. Prime Minister Vajpayee of India came to Washington for a state visit, and on September 19th, the Senate followed the House in approving the bill granting normal trade relations with China, thus clearing the way for its entry into the WTO. I was convinced that in time it would prove to be one of the most important foreign policy developments of my 8 years. Hillary had a good September. She had won the primary on the 12th and handily defeated Lazio in their debate moderated by Tim Russert in Buffalo. Lazio had three problems. He claimed that the still-distressed economy of upstate New York had turned the corner, ran a misleading ad for which he was called to account that implied that Senator Moynihan was supporting him, not Hillary, and got in Hillary's face and tried to bully her into signing a pledge on campaign finance that was not credible. All Hillary had to do was keep her composure and answer the questions, which she did very well. A week later, a new poll showed her leading Lazio 48-39% with new strength among suburban women. On September 16th, I bid an emotional farewell to a large, predominantly African-American crowd at the Congressional Black Caucus dinner, reviewing the record, making my case for Gore and Lieberman, and asking their support for well-qualified but still unconfirmed black judges. Then I threw away the script and closed with these words. I thank you from the bottom of my heart. Toni Morrison once said I was the first black president this country ever had, and I would rather have that than a Nobel Prize. And I'll tell you why. Because somewhere in the deep and lost threads of my own memory are the roots of understanding of what you have known. Somewhere there was a deep longing to share the fate of the people who had been left out and left behind, sometimes brutalized and too often ignored or forgotten. I don't exactly know who all I have to thank for that, but I'm quite sure I don't deserve any credit for it, because whatever I did, I really felt I had no other choice. I made the same points a few days later on September 20th to the Congressional Hispanic Caucus dinner and to the Bishop's Conference of the Church of God and Christ, where I noted that there were only 120 days left in my presidency and that I would give them 120 hard days working with Congress and trying to make peace in the Middle East. I knew I'd have an opportunity to win some more victories as Congress wound down, but I wasn't so sure about the Middle East. Several days later, my economic team was with me as I announced that median income had risen by more than $1,000 in the last year, taking it above $40,000 for the first time in our history, and that the number of Americans without health insurance had dropped by 1.7 million the previous year, the first major decline in 12 years. On September 25th, after weeks of efforts by our team to get peace talks back on track, Barack invited Arafat to his home for dinner. Near the end of the meal, I called and had a good talk with both of them. The next day, both sides sent negotiators to Washington to take up where they had left off at Camp David. On the 28th, everything changed, as Ariel Sharon became the first leading Israeli politician to walk on the Temple Mount since Israel captured it in the 1967 war. At the time, Moshe Dayan had said that Muslim religious sites would be respected, and thereafter the mount was overseen by Muslims. Arafat said he had asked Barak to prevent Sharon's stroll, which was clearly intended to affirm Israel's sovereignty over the site, and to strengthen his hand against a challenge to his leadership of the Likud party from former Prime Minister Netanyahu, who was now sounding more hawkish than Sharon. I had also hoped Barak would prevent Sharon's inflammatory escapade, but Barak told me he couldn't. Instead, Sharon was forbidden to enter the Dome of the Rock or the Al-Aqsa Mosque and was escorted to the mount by a large number of heavily armed police officers. I and others on our team had urged Arafat to prevent violence. It was a great opportunity for the Palestinians for once to refuse to be provoked. I thought Sharon should have been greeted with flowers by Palestinian children and told that when the Temple Mount was under Palestinian control, he would be welcome any time. But as Abba Iban had said long ago, the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. The next day, there were large Palestinian demonstrations near the Western Wall, during which Israeli police opened fire with rubber bullets on stone throwers and others. At least 5 people were killed and hundreds were wounded. As the violence persisted, 2 vivid images of pain and futility emerged. A 12-year-old Palestinian boy shot in the crossfire and dying in his father's arms, and 2 Israeli soldiers pulled from a building and beaten to death, with their lifeless bodies dragged through the streets, and one of their assailants proudly showing his blood-stained hands to the world on television. While the Middle East was exploding, the Balkans was getting better. In the last week of September, Slobodan Milosevic was defeated for the presidency of Serbia by Vojislav Koštunica in a campaign in which we had helped ensure that the election could not be stolen and Koštunica could get his message out. Milosevic tried to steal the election anyway, but massive demonstrations convinced him he couldn't get away with it. And on October 6th, the prime mover behind the Balkan slaughters admitted defeat. In early October, I hosted a meeting in the cabinet room for supporters of the Debt Relief Initiative. Reverend Pat Robertson was there. His strong support and that of the evangelical Christian community showed how broad and deep support for debt relief had become. In the House, the effort was being pushed by Maxine Waters, one of our most liberal members, and Conservative Budget Committee Chairman John Kasich. Even Jesse Helms was supporting it, thanks in no small measure to Bono's personal outreach to him. The early results were encouraging. Bolivia had spent $77 million on health and education. Uganda had doubled primary school enrollment, and Honduras was to go from 6 to 9 years of mandatory schooling. I was aiming to get the rest of our contribution in the final budget agreement. In the second week of the month, Hillary did well in her second, more civilized debate with Rick Lazio. I signed the China trade bill and thanked Charlene Barshefsky and Gene Sperling for their arduous trek to China to hammer out our agreement at the 11th hour. Signed into law my Lands Legacy Initiative and the new investments for Native American communities, and on October 11th in Chappaqua, met Hillary to celebrate our 25th wedding anniversary. It seemed like only yesterday when we were young and just beginning. Now our daughter was almost out of college, and the White House years were almost over. I was confident Hillary would win the Senate race, and optimistic about what the future held for all of us. My brief reverie was shattered the next day when a small boat laden with explosives blew up beside the USS Cole in the port of Aden, Yemen. 17 sailors were killed in what was obviously a terrorist attack. We all thought it was the work of bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, but we couldn't be sure. The CIA went to work on it, and I sent officials from defense, state, and the FBI to Yemen, where President Ali Saleh had promised to cooperate fully in the investigation and in bringing the murderers to justice. Meanwhile, I continued to push the Pentagon and the National Security Team for more options to get bin Laden. We came close to launching another missile strike at him in October, but the CIA recommended that we call it off at the last minute, believing that the evidence of his presence was insufficiently reliable. The Pentagon recommended against putting special forces into Afghanistan with all the attendant logistical difficulties unless we had more reliable intelligence on bin Laden's whereabouts. That left bigger military options, a large-scale bombing campaign of all suspected campsites or a sizable invasion. I thought neither was feasible without a finding of Al-Qaeda responsibility for the coal. I was very frustrated, and I hoped that before I left office we would locate bin Laden for a missile strike. After campaign stops in Colorado and Washington, I flew to Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, for a summit on the Middle East violence with President Mubarak, King Abdullah, Kofi Annan, and Javier Solana, now Secretary General of the European Union. All of them wanted to end the violence, as did Crown Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, who was not there but had already weighed in on the subject. Barack and Arafat were present, but might as well have been on opposite sides of the world from each other. Barack wanted the violence stopped. Arafat wanted an inquiry into the alleged excessive use of force by the Israeli military and police. George Tenet worked out a security plan with both sides, and I had to sell it to Barak and Arafat, as well as a statement to be read at the end of the summit. I told Arafat that I had intended to present a proposal to resolve the outstanding issues in the peace talks, but couldn't do so until he agreed to the security plan. There could be no peace without shutting down the violence. Arafat agreed to the plan. We then worked until early in the morning on a statement for me to issue on behalf of all the parties. It contained three parts: a commitment to end the violence, the establishment of a fact-finding committee to look into what had caused the uprising and the conduct of both sides, appointed by the United States with the Israelis and Palestinians and in consultation with Kofi Annan, and a commitment to move forward with the peace talks. It sounds simple, but it wasn't. Arafat wanted a UN committee and immediate resumption of the talks. Barak wanted a U.S. committee and enough delay to see whether the violence would subside. Mubarak and I finally met alone with Arafat and persuaded him to accept the statement. I couldn't have done it without Hosni. I had thought he was often too resistant to getting deeply involved in the peace process, but that night he was strong, clear, and effective. When I returned to the United States, Hillary, Chelsea, and I went to Norfolk, Virginia for a memorial service for victims of the USS Cole bombing and private meetings with their grieving families. Like the airmen at Khobar Towers, our sailors had been killed in a very different conflict from the kind they had been trained to fight. In this one, the enemy was elusive. Everyone was a potential target. Our enormous arsenal was not a deterrent, and the openness and information technology of the modern world were being used against us. I knew that eventually we would prevail in the struggle against bin Laden, but I didn't know how many innocent people would lose their lives before we figured out how to do it. 2 days later, Hillary, Alan Tipper Gore, and I went to Jefferson City, Missouri, for a memorial service for Governor Mel Carnahan, his son, and a young aide who had been killed when their small plane crashed. Carnahan and I had been close since he endorsed me early in the 1992 campaign. He had been a fine governor and a leader in welfare reform, and at the time of his death, he was in a tight race with the incumbent, John Ashcroft, in the U.S. Senate race. It was too late to put someone else on the ballot. A few days later, Jean Carnahan said that if the people of Missouri voted for her husband, she would serve. They did, and Jean served with distinction. In the last days of October, as the presidential election came down to the wire, I signed a trade agreement with Jordan's King Abdullah, continued to sign and veto bills, and campaigned in Indiana, Kentucky, Massachusetts, and New York, where I did several events for Hillary. The most fun was a birthday celebration in which Robert De Niro gave me instructions on how to talk like a real New Yorker. Ever since the convention, Al Gore had framed the election as a contest of the people versus the powerful. That it was. Every conceivable conservative interest group, the health insurance industry, the tobacco companies, the heavily polluting industries, the NRA, and many more, was for Governor Bush. The problem with the slogan was that it didn't give Al the full benefit of our record of economic and social progress, or put into sharp relief Bush's explicit commitment to undo that progress. Also, the populist edge sounded to some swing voters as if Al, too, might change the economic direction of the country. Along toward the end of the month, Al started saying, "Don't put the prosperity at risk." By the 1st of November, he was moving up in the polls, though still down by about 4 points. In the last week of the campaign, at Governor Gray Davis's request, I flew to California for 2 days of campaigning for the ticket and our congressional candidates, did a big event in Harlem for Hillary, then on Sunday went home to Arkansas to campaign for Mike Ross, who had served as my driver in the 1982 governor's campaign and was running against Republican Congressman Jay Dickey. I spent the day before the election and election day doing more than 60 radio interviews across the country, urging people to vote for Al and Joe and our local Democrats. I had already recorded more than 170 radio ads and telephone messages to be dialed into homes of hardcore Democrats and minorities, asking them to vote for our candidates. On Election Day, Hillary, Chelsea, and I voted at Douglas Grafflin Elementary School, our local polling station in Chappaqua. It was a strange and wonderful experience. Strange because the school was the only place I'd ever voted outside Arkansas, and after 26 years in political life, my name wasn't on the ballot. Wonderful because I got to vote for Hillary. Chelsea and I voted first, then hugged each other as we watched Hillary close the curtain and cast a ballot for herself. Election night was a roller coaster. Hillary won the election 55-43%, a much larger margin than she had in all the pre-election polls but one. I was so proud of her. New York had put her through the ringer just as it had done to me in 1992. She had been up, down, and up again, but she kept her bearings and pressed ahead. As we celebrated her victory at the Grand Hyatt Hotel in New York City, Bush and Gore were neck and neck. For weeks, everyone had known the election would be close, with many commentators saying that Gore might lose the popular vote but still win the Electoral College. 2 days before the election, as I looked at the map and the latest polls, I told Steve Ricchetti that I was afraid the reverse could occur. Our base voters had been activated and would turn out as eagerly as the Republicans who wanted the White House back. Al was going to win big states by large margins, but Bush was going to win more small rural states, and they had an advantage in the Electoral College because every state got one electoral vote for each House member plus two extra ones for its senators. Going into Election Day, I still thought Al would win because he had the momentum and he was right on the issues. Gore did win by more than 500,000 votes, but the Electoral College was in doubt. The race came down to Florida after Gore won a narrow victory of 366 votes in New Mexico, one of several states that were closer than they would have been had Ralph Nader not been on the ballot. I had asked Bill Richardson to spend the last week in his home state, and he may well have made the difference. Of the states I had won in 1996, Bush picked up Nevada, Arizona, Missouri, Arkansas, Tennessee, Kentucky, Ohio, West Virginia, and New Hampshire. Tennessee had been growing increasingly Republican. In 1992, 1996, and 2000, the Democratic vote had held steady at between 47% and 48%. The NRA also hurt Al badly there and in several other states, including Arkansas. For example, Yale County, where the Clintons had settled a century earlier, is a populist, culturally conservative county a Democrat has to win to carry the state in a tight race. Gore lost it to Bush 50-47%. The NRA did that. I might have been able to turn it around, but it would have taken 2 or 3 days of rural work to do it, and I didn't know how big the problem was until I went home right before the election. The gun lobby tried to beat Al in Michigan and Pennsylvania and might have done so had it not been for a heroic effort by the local labor unions, which had a lot of NRA members themselves. They fought back by saying, "Gore won't take your gun away, but Bush will take your union away." Unfortunately, in the rural areas of Arkansas, Tennessee, Kentucky, West Virginia, Missouri, and Ohio, there weren't enough union members to win the war on the ground. In Kentucky, our stand against the big tobacco companies marketing cigarettes to kids hurt Al in the tobacco-growing areas. In West Virginia, he was damaged by the failure of Weirton Steel, an employee-owned company. The employees and their families were convinced the collapse was caused by my failure to limit cheap imported steel from Russia and Asia during the Asian financial crisis. The evidence indicated that the company had failed for other reasons, but the Weirton workers thought otherwise, and Al paid the price. New Hampshire went for Bush by a margin of just over 7,000 because Nader got 22,198 votes. Even worse, Nader received more than 90,000 votes in Florida, where Bush was hanging on by a thread in an election contest that would drag on for more than a month. As the Florida vote battle began, it was clear that we had picked up 4 seats in the Senate and 1 in the House. 3 incumbent House Republicans were defeated, including Jay Dickey, who lost to Mike Ross in Arkansas, and the Democrats picked up 4 seats in California, prevailing in all but one of the contested races. Al was at a disadvantage going into the election recount in Florida, because the chief election official, Secretary of State Catherine Harris, was a conservative Republican who was close to Governor Jeb Bush, and the state legislature that would certify the electors was dominated by conservative Republicans. On the other hand, the state Supreme Court, which presumably would have the final say on the counting of ballots, had more judges appointed by Democratic governors and was thought to be less partisan. 2 days later, still not knowing who my successor would be, I saw Arafat in the Oval Office. The violence was subsiding, and I thought he might be serious about peace. I told him that I had only 10 weeks left to make an agreement. In a private moment, I held his arm, stared straight at him, and told him I also had a chance to make an agreement with North Korea to end its long-range missile production, but I would have to go there to do it. The whole trip would take a week or longer by the time I made the obligatory stops in South Korea, Japan, and China. If we were going to make peace in the Middle East, I knew I would have to close the deal. I told Arafat I had done everything I could to get the Palestinians a state on the West Bank and Gaza while protecting the security of Israel. After all my efforts, if Arafat wasn't going to make peace, he owed it to me to tell me so that I could go to North Korea to end another serious security threat. He pleaded with me to stay, saying that we had to finish the peace and that if we didn't do it before I left office, it would be at least 5 years before we'd be this close to peace again. That night we had a dinner to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the White House. Lady Bird Johnson, President and Mrs. Ford, President and Mrs. Carter, and President and Mrs. Bush were all there to mark the birthday of the People's House, which every president since John Adams had inhabited. It was a wonderful moment in American history, but a tense one for President and Mrs. Bush, who had to be on edge with their son's election hanging fire. I was glad they had come. A few days later, Chelsea and I went to Brunei for the annual APEC summit. Sultan Hassan al-Bolkiah hosted our meeting in a beautiful new hotel and convention center. We made some headway on the reforms necessary to avoid another Asian financial crisis, and Singapore Prime Minister Goh Chok Tong and I agreed to start negotiations on a bilateral free trade agreement. I also enjoyed a round of golf with Prime Minister Goh on a night golf course designed to help golfers manage the intense heat. I had instituted the APEC leaders meeting back in 1993, and I was pleased with the expansion of the group and the work done since then. At my last APEC meeting, I thought the effort had borne fruit, not simply in specific agreements, but also in building an institution that tied the United States to Asia in the new century. After Brunei, Chelsea and I went to Vietnam for a historic visit to Hanoi, Ho Chi Minh City, the old Saigon, and a site where Vietnamese were working with Americans to unearth the remains of our men still listed as missing in action. Hillary flew in to join us from Israel, where she had gone to attend the funeral of Leah Rabin. I met with the Communist Party leader, the president, the prime minister, and the mayor of Ho Chi Minh City. The higher the position, the more likely the leader was to sound like an old-style communist. The party leader, Lê Khả Phiêu, tried to use my opposition to the Vietnam War to condemn what the United States had done as an imperialist act. I was angry about it, especially since he said it in the presence of our ambassador, Pete Peterson, who had been a prisoner of war. I told the leader in no uncertain terms that while I had disagreed with our Vietnam policy, those who had pursued it were not imperialists or colonialists, but good people who believed they were fighting communism. I pointed at Pete and said he hadn't spent 6.5 years in the prison known as the Hanoi Hilton because he wanted to colonize Vietnam. We had turned a new page with normalized relations, the trade agreement, and two-way cooperation on MIA issues. Now was not the time to reopen old wounds. The president, Tran Duc Luong, was only a little less dogmatic. Prime Minister Phan Van Khai and I had established a good relationship at the APEC meetings. A year earlier, he had told me he appreciated my opposition to the war. When I said that the Americans who disagreed with me and supported the war were good people who wanted freedom for the Vietnamese, he replied, "I know." Khai was interested in the future and hoped the United States would give Vietnam assistance in caring for the victims of Agent Orange and developing its economy. The mayor of Ho Chi Minh City, Vo Viet Thanh, sounded like every good aggressive American mayor I knew. He bragged about balancing his budget, reducing his payroll, and working for more foreign investment. Besides the officials, I shook hands with a large crowd of friendly people who gathered spontaneously to greet us after an informal lunch at a local restaurant. They wanted to build a common future. The trip to the MIA site was an experience none of us would ever forget. I thought back over the years to my high school classmates who had died in Vietnam, and to the man I'd helped when I was in Moscow in 1970, who was searching for information about his missing son. The Americans working with the Vietnamese crew believed, based on information from local residents, that a missing pilot, Lieutenant Colonel Lawrence Everett, had crashed there more than 30 years earlier. His now-grown children accompanied us to the site. Working knee-deep in mud with the Vietnamese, our soldiers cut the mud into large chunks, took it to a nearby shed, and sifted through it. They had already recovered parts of the plane and a uniform, and were close to having enough for an identification. The work was supervised by an American archaeologist who was himself a Vietnam veteran. He said this was the most rewarding dig in the world. The care and detail of their work was amazing, as were the efforts of the Vietnamese to help. Soon the Everts found their father. On the way home from Vietnam, I found out that Chuck Ruff, my White House counsel during the impeachment proceeding, had died suddenly. When I landed, I went to see his wife, Sue. Chuck was an extraordinary man who had led our defense team in the Senate with skill and courage. The rest of November was consumed by the Middle East and the Florida recount, which was cut off with thousands of votes still uncounted in three big counties, a result unfair to Gore since it was obvious from the votes that had been thrown out for errors resulting from confusing ballots and flawed punch card devices that thousands more Floridians had intended to vote for Gore than for Bush. Gore contested the election in court. At the same time, Barack and Arafat were meeting again in the Middle East. It wasn't clear to me whether we were going to win or lose either the battle for Florida or the struggle for peace. On December 5th, Hillary went to Capitol Hill for her initiation as a freshman senator. The night before, I kidded her about going to her first day of senator school, telling her she had to get a good night's sleep and wear a nice outfit. She was excited about it, and I was really happy for her. 3 days later, I traveled to Nebraska, the only state I had not yet visited as president, for a speech at the University of Nebraska at Kearney. It was in effect a valedictory address in the heartland urging continued American leadership in the world beyond our borders. Meanwhile, the Florida Supreme Court ordered the inclusion of more recounted votes in Palm Beach and Dade counties and the recount of 45,000 more votes according to the standard of Florida law. A ballot was to be counted only if the intent of the voter was clear. Bush's margin was now down to 154 votes. Governor Bush immediately appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court to stop the recount. Several lawyers told me the Supreme Court wouldn't take the case. The mechanics of elections were a question of state law unless they were used to discriminate against a group of citizens, like racial minorities. Also, it is difficult to get a court-ordered injunction against an otherwise legal action, like an election recount or raising a building when the owner agrees. To do so, a party must show that irreparable harm would result unless the activity is stopped. In a 5-4 decision, Justice Scalia wrote an astonishingly honest opinion, granting the injunction. "What was the irreparable harm?" Scalia said. "That counting the ballots might, cast a cloud upon what Bush claims to be the legitimacy of his election. Well, he was right about that. If Gore got more votes than Bush in Florida, it would be harder for the Supreme Court to give Bush the presidency anyway. We were having a Christmas reception at the White House that night, and I asked every lawyer who came through the receiving line if he or she had ever heard of such a ruling. No one had. The court was to hand down another opinion shortly on the underlying issue of whether the recount itself was constitutional. Now we knew they would kill it 5-4. I told Hillary that Scalia would never be allowed to write the second opinion. He had been too candid in this one. On December 11th, Hillary, Chelsea, and I flew to Ireland, to the land of my ancestors and the scene of so much of the peacemaking I had done. We stopped in Dublin to see Bertie Ahern, then went to Dundalk near the border for a massive rally in a city that was once a hotbed of IRA activity and was now a force for peace. The streets were bright with Christmas lights as the large crowd cheered wildly and sang Danny Boy to me. Seamus Heaney once said of Yeats, "His interest was to clear a space in the mind and in the world for the miraculous." I thanked the Irish for filling that space with the miracle of peace. We went to Belfast, where I met with the Northern Irish leaders, including David Trimble, Seamus Mallon, John Hume, and Gerry Adams. Then we went with Tony and Cherie Blair, Bertie Ahern, and George Mitchell to a large meeting of both Catholics and Protestants in the Odyssey Arena. It was still somewhat unusual for them to gather together in Belfast. Some sharp disputes remained involving the new police force and the schedule and method of putting arms beyond use. I asked them to keep working on the problems and remember that the enemies of peace didn't need their approval. All they need is your apathy. I reminded the audience that the Good Friday Accord had given heart to peacemakers the world over and cited the just-announced agreement ending the bloody conflict between Eritrea and Ethiopia that the United States had helped broker. I closed by saying how much I had loved working with them for peace. But the issue is not how I feel, it's how your kids are going to live. After the event, my family flew to England to stay with the Blairs at Chequers and listen to Al Gore give his concession speech. The night before, at 10 p.m., the Supreme Court had ruled 7-2 that the Florida recount was unconstitutional because there were no uniform standards for defining the clear intent of the voter for purposes of a recount, and therefore, different vote counters might count or interpret the same ballots differently. Therefore, the court said, allowing any of the disputed votes to be counted, no matter how clear the voter's intent, would deny equal protection of the law to those whose ballots weren't counted. I disagreed strongly with the decision, but I was heartened that Justices Souter and Breyer wanted to send the case back to the Florida Supreme Court to set a standard and proceed with the recount in a hurry. The Electoral College was meeting soon. The other five justices in the majority disagreed. By 5-4, the same five justices who had stopped the vote count 3 days earlier now said it had to give the election to Bush because under Florida law, the recount had to be finished by midnight on that day anyway. It was an appalling decision. A narrow conservative majority that had made a virtual fetish of states' rights had now stripped Florida of a clear state function, the right to recount votes the way it always had. The five justices who didn't want the votes counted by any standard claimed to advance equal protection by depriving thousands of people of their constitutional right to have their votes counted, even if their intent was crystal clear. They said Bush should be awarded the election because the votes couldn't be counted in the next 2 hours, when after already killing 3 days of recounting, they had delayed issuing the opinion until 10 p.m. to make absolutely sure the recount could not be completed on time. The five-vote majority didn't make any bones about what it was up to. The opinion clearly stated that the ruling could not be used as precedent in future election law cases. Its reasoning was limited to the present circumstances, for the problem of equal protection in election processes generally presents many complexities. If Gore had been ahead in the vote count and Bush behind, there's not a doubt in my mind that the same Supreme Court would have voted 9-0 to count the votes. And I would have supported the decision. Bush versus Gore will go down in history as one of the worst decisions the Supreme Court ever made, along with the Dred Scott case, which said that a slave who escaped to freedom was still a piece of property to be returned to its owner. Plessy versus Ferguson, upholding the legality of racial segregation, the cases in the 20s and 30s invalidating legislative protections for workers, like minimum wage and maximum workweek laws, as violations of the property rights of employers, and the Korematsu case, in which the Supreme Court approved the blanket internment of Japanese Americans in camps after Pearl Harbor. We had lived through and rejected the premises of all these previous reactionary decisions. I knew America would also get beyond this dark day when five Republican justices stripped thousands of their fellow Americans of their votes just because they could. Al Gore gave a marvelous concession speech. It was genuine, gracious, and patriotic.
End of Disc 20.